The summers of 27 and 2018 were dismal, even for people who did not get within miles of a forest fire, because the smoke from the fires came to us in much of the region. Large destructive fires were frequent and not too far apart, and smoke up to hazardous levels hung in the air for weeks at a time. We caught a break for most of 2019, and that's when the Oregon Governor's Council on Wildfire Response was hard at work, producing a list of recommendations for avoiding the likes of 2017 and 2018. The governor appointed the council, which recently delivered its final report. Two of the members join us here by phone. We have State Representative Pam Marsh, a Democrat from Ashland, on the line. Representative Marsh, thanks for joining us once again.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. Chris Chambers is with us as well. He's the Wildfire Division Chief at Ashland Fire and Rescue. Chris, good to see you.
Always great to be here. Thank you.
So we caught a break with a very mild fire season, but how much pressure did members of the council feel to deliver something and relatively quickly? Pam Marsh?
Well, I think while we had a very welcome respite in 2019, none of us would deny that, it's very clear that we have a long-term trajectory that is going to introduce a constant presence of smoke and wildfire to our communities. So I don't think the council saw the season in 2019 as providing any sort of relief to our mission, which was really to come up with a plan that would address these issues for decades to come.
Chris Chambers, how often did the council meet and what was the process?
We were meeting monthly, and that started back even earlier in the year. And then came out with a report just in early November. So it was pretty busy. There were committees that met more frequently than that in order to get recommendations out to the larger council for approval by November. So it was a lot of busy work.
It seems like a lot of these ideas are already on the table. It's not like people had not been talking about things like treating the forests to reduce the amount of growth on the forest floor so you don't get the fires that start on the forest floor and get up into the crown. So was it more or less, I mean, you had to do some research and some staff work, I would think, to get to this, but a lot of it was still essentially out there already, wasn't it?
Yeah, a lot of the knowledge and experience and how to actually accomplish the work, and we've been doing that for over 10 years here in Ashland. And there's plenty of places across the state who are doing similar work. But I think the important part about the council was bringing all of the players together at the table and not just those that would conventionally be thought of as responsible for these kinds of things like the U.S. Forest Service, the BLM, ODF, really bringing in all affected parties by wildfire. Certainly, as we look what's happening in California, the utilities are an incredibly important player in this. Water delivery, municipalities, counties, and then people across the spectrum from healthcare, which of course is really important, as we saw in the bad smoke summers here, affecting public health in a really serious way. And also interested parties like from private foundations who have a stake in what's happening in Oregon. The list goes on and on, tribes, I never forget that. So the list does get pretty deep when you look at the council, and really it is a societal problem, and we needed everybody at the table.
So Pam Marsh, having been on a city council, having been in the Oregon legislature, serving on a number of committees, I mean, how were you sort of prepared for this kind of work? Did it move differently from that kind of work?
I think the main challenge that we really had in this was a pretty short timeline. We know that there is a lot of pressure to come up with some ways to address smoke and fire. And so while the committee came together in the spring, we produced this report by November. That's not a lot of time to do, which is a body of work, which is of great magnitude. So I think that was a challenge. I think there's more work to come. What this report does, I think, is catalog the breadth of responses that we need to make, and it also defines the magnitude of the problem. There are a lot of details that still need to be filled in as to how exactly this work unrolls. But I think it's a good compilation of the science and the knowledge that we have out on the issues.
Well, you know, media organizations are going to tend to go for things like dollars and cents first, and the number that most organizations plucked out is $4 billion just as preventive medicine. I should point out that's meant to be spread over 20 years, but what would that pay for, Pam Marsh?
Well, it's basically just a math calculation. We know how many acres that we have that are at great risk. We know that we need to treat about 40% of those acres. That comes out to roughly 5 to 6 million acres should we do all the work. And then you simply multiply that by an average cost, and you get to that $4 billion question. So that's a very rough number. But I think its value is that it just shows us how big the problem is.
How much more could be spent if the steps represented by the $4 billion are not taken?
Well, we know that smoke and fire has these tremendous impacts on our community in some ways around issues that we can't easily calculate in numbers. What are the impacts to health? What are the long-term impacts for people who are living through intense smoke experiences? We know that we have economic issues on our communities that are dealing with these things. In 2019, certainly in the community of Ashland, we saw communities, businesses really struggle to try to maintain themselves with some long-term consequences when people stay inside for 6 weeks and tourism doesn't occur in the way that it normally does. There's a big price to pay. So, and there are the costs simply of suppression. We know that we can calculate spending about $500 million in an average suppression season in the future in Oregon. Take that base number, pile on the economic damages, the health damages, and you're getting up into the billions very quickly.
We're talking about the Governor's Council on Wildfire Response in Oregon, which recently delivered its report on what needs to be done to prevent destructive and smoky fire seasons like Oregon had recently. Got a break in 2019. We're talking to Representative Pam Marsh, a Democrat from Ashland, from the state legislature who has sat on the council, and Chris Chambers is the Wildfire Division Chief of Ashland Fire and Rescue. He also sat on the council. You can ask questions of these council members about where to proceed from here and things you would like to see in the future. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Chris Chambers, let's talk to concepts beyond numbers. There were basically three major goals, as I see in the executive summary. Can you lay those out for us?
Sure. What the council recommended and followed through on is using the model that was already created by the National Cohesive Wildfire Management Strategy. That plan has been in place at the national level for over a decade now. And Oregon basically is just going to sync up with what's happening across the West, across the whole nation, and also make it easy to communicate with our federal partners who are following those goals. So there's three goals. There's fire-adapted communities. So that's what we're doing around the places that we live to protect the infrastructure, homes, businesses, economy in the built environment. There's resilient landscapes, which is the forests that are surrounding us, and of course, incredibly important to the economy and well-being of Oregon, and also, of course, high values for wildlife habitat and water quality. Wildfire response is that third category. So what happens when the fire starts, the bell goes off? What do we do? Do we run out there every time and put the fire out? Or are there other responses? Do we have the right number of resources and funding available? So those discussions all happened in subcommittees to each of those different three topics.
Well, the first element of fire-adapted communities is utilities. Pam Marsh, we've certainly been watching in recent weeks as PG&E on the California side shuts off power to areas where there's fire danger coming. Was any of this going on yet, or it certainly was under discussion, I think, in California when the council was doing its work in Oregon? Are we talking about potential situations like this on the Oregon side?
Well, we're certainly hoping that we can take some actions to prevent situations like that. I think all of us on November 8th of last year sat around and watched what happened in Paradise, California, and wondered if that could be us. So Pacific Power, which has in its territory most of the state of Oregon that might be most susceptible to these kind of fire risks, has been looking at this pretty intensely over the last year. They have unrolled plans that caused, frankly, some concern in our communities around potential power shutoffs, and our emergency planners have come together with Pacific Power to try to figure out what that might look like and where our vulnerable communities are to make sure that we have backup plans in place should the power go off. And one of the significant recommendations in the report is that the power companies work closely with the Public Utility Commission to make sure that there are plans in place for both assessing when power needs to be turned off and then for making sure that communities are ready for that experience. We want to head off what we're seeing in California, absolutely.
So let me restate the three major goals in this portion of the report from the Governor's Council on Wildfire Response is fire-adapted communities, resilient landscapes, and wildfire response. So Chris Chambers, Ashland is already well down the road of a fire-adapted community, but how much more do you think would need to be done to ensure that a fire at the city's edge, for example, would not turn catastrophic?
There's always more to do. As I walk around streets during the summertime, I still see mulch pushed up against people's wood siding. I see leaves and needles packed in people's gutters. So the easy things for homeowners to do is really going to have to be a shift in the way that we're used to living around here. We can't be lazy about this anymore. And that's going to go for a lot of places in Oregon and a lot of places that aren't used to seeing as frequent of a fire or as intense of a fire as they're going to see in the future. The fringes of the Willamette Valley, the west slope of the Cascades, the Coast Range, those are places where climate change is going to have impacts on wet forests, lengthening the summer season, the fire seasons, creating hotter, drier conditions than people are used to seeing, and really setting communities up for fire that are not as aware of fire, at least as Ashland is, and I still see that Ashland has a long way to go, and so some of these communities really have a long way to start adapting to the rapidly changing climate and real increasing frequency of wildfire.
I'm getting a sense that we're talking about people who may have moved to Ashland and think, well, I live in a suburban neighborhood. I live in a leafy suburb, as people like to say lately. I'm not a guy who lives out in the country, but the fact is they're going to have to treat their property like they do live out in the country in some cases anyway.
Indeed. With the topography and the kind of fuels that surround Ashland and many communities throughout Southwest Oregon, certainly Northern California as well in the listening area, an ember from a wildfire can travel a mile and start another fire, no problem. Some extreme conditions even further than that. So people who live within a mile of wildland vegetation, and that doesn't have to be the mountains and the forest. That could be a wildland-type park. It can be a riparian area. We saw some bad stuff happen out in Central Point last year in the Penninger Fire, 100 acres, and somebody actually died, threatened the airport, Costco. Places that you really wouldn't normally think about wildfires affecting, and certainly that trend of entire communities being impacted by wildfire is on the increase, of course, most famously in Paradise, but there are many others. And the effects of climate change are predicted to move from south to north and from lower elevations to higher elevations. So when we look down at California and don't like what we see, that should mean that Oregon needs to start working really hard towards a better, safer future.
The Fire Adapted Communities section of the Governor's Council on Wildfire Response report includes things like building codes, land use, filtration systems for homes, air quality monitors, and I notice more staffing for Oregon Emergency Management. Pam Marsh, how much bigger are we talking about here?
Well, the report recommends that we put about a half a dozen personnel out in our communities. We recognized when Pacific Power started having its discussion about potential power shutoffs, how little capacity we have in our communities to do emergency planning. And we know, whether it's wildfires or earthquakes, that we really need to have systems in place to keep people safe. So the report takes that on and suggests that we try to bolster the capabilities that we have in local communities.
We're talking about the work of the Governor's Council on Wildfire Response in Oregon, which was set up by executive order in January of 2019, put out its report just a few weeks ago. State Representative Pam Marsh was a member of that council. So was Chris Chambers, the Forestry Division Chief of Ashland Fire. Questions, comments from you about where things go from here? Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. One of the things I noticed in the executive summary from from the council, Pam Marsh, is that each of the particular subheadings under each of the goals lists priority. And I notice when we get to resilient landscapes that nothing in that section is listed below high priority. So this is really a concern that we take care of the landscapes to make sure we don't get the fires themselves in the first place, or at least the way that we've been getting them.
Absolutely. And you know what? I think that's the big takeaway from this report is there's a section of the report on suppression. We know fires have always occurred. We have to figure out how to put them out. But the big news in this report is that there are strategies that we can take on that actually will keep us safer, that will minimize the fire on our landscape. And that's that section around resilient landscapes. We haven't talked about that so much in the past. So now we're putting that front and center and saying, what are the activities we can do in our own communities? And Chris just talked about some of those. And what are the activities that we can do in the adjacent forest to make sure that it is as resilient as possible to keep us as safe as possible?
So, Chris Chambers, you've been involved for years now with the Ashland Forest Resiliency Stewardship Project, and I was asking when you came into the room how big that is, because just on a basis of comparison, you're talking about 12,500 acres being treated here. The book recommends something like 300,000 acres a year. We're talking a big, big job here then, aren't we?
A huge job. And, you know, although it sent me to look at the big $4 billion number, and it seems like a lot of money, though it is spread over 20 years, and it's still a lot of money. But that money is going to be spent, and that money is going to be spent times 10 and more if we just embrace the business as usual scenario. So something like treating the forest, the money doesn't fall into a black hole. These are actually creating good-paying jobs for Oregonians out there. The plan that we have for Southwest Oregon, which is called the Rogue Basin Strategy, which was a little bit ahead of the work done in the governor's council, but basically ended up mirroring that. We have the potential to create 1,700 jobs here in Southwest Oregon over the next 20 years. That is a lot of people put to work from all different sectors. And we've put actually in just even the small project that is Ashland Forest Resiliency, we've put over $25 million into the local economy over the last 10 years in that project. So that means something to people out there, and we're going to need all kinds of work, from highly technical, professional, skilled work, to people in the forest who are trained to run saws and know about control burns. So there's a lot of place out there for a whole range of folks to plug into this and work entire careers doing this.
Let me take a call here from Gretchen in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about wildfire response with Chris Chambers and Pam Marsh.
Yes, good morning. My question is sort of answered by that last comment related to getting the forest fire safe by doing understory thinning specifically, both private and public. So my questions related to that are, one is making sure that we maintain on the public lands the NEPA process that we already have in place, meaning surveys for particular whether owls or rare plants or other environmental concerns, that would continue to happen on the public lands and not take that away. And on the private, wondering how you instigate more thinning on private. And then I have a different question, so I'll say that, and then I'll take my answers off the air. The other is, in some of these big urban fires or rural fires, the travel of fire from house to house is not always like roof shingles to roof shingles or even trees. What I'm understanding is that it can happen underneath the eaves.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've read about that. I'm curious if you've studied that. And
yeah, we have talked about that before.
About that.
Okay, thanks for that, Gretchen. I want to give a good time for an answer here. So, Pam Marsh, do you want to take on the issue of the NEPA part of this? I mean, are we talking about on public lands, there'll still be a process for people to be able to have input and comments?
Absolutely. And actually what the report suggests is that we start by looking at acreage that's already gone through the NEPA process, because we know where the high-risk areas are, and we also have big tracts of the landscape that have already undergone the environmental assessment process. So a logical starting point is to look at places where those overlay landscapes that have been analyzed and that also are clearly high-risk areas. That just makes sense as an efficient way to start this process.
So Chris Chambers about the idea of fires in the eaves and things like that. I mean, is that part of the building codes portion of this? Is that specifically mentioned?
Yeah, that's actually a section that I ended up working on quite a bit. There is an updated option for building codes in the state of Oregon that just became available this January after a lot of work at the state level, specifically through the city of Medford and the city of Ashland fire departments pushing for this, among others. So that option in the building code can be adopted by any local jurisdiction. That can be a county, city, fire district. So that's out there right now. The city of Medford was just successful, the first one to adopt that in the state of Oregon. Ashland's ramping up to do the same, as are many other communities looking at that. So basically, that's just saying we got to stop the bleeding now. We can't keep building houses that are susceptible to wildfire while we're trying to solve the same wildfire problems and building flammable structures. So that's one component of it. The other component is just managing vegetation in that direct area around the home, commonly called defensible space. So that area out, usually out to 100 feet, is considered defensible space. And making sure that there aren't flammable plants planted close to eaves. And so it's not it's not a matter of fire being transferred through the eaves. The mechanism is typically through either exposure of homes to homes that are burning and or through embers that are flying through the air as a result of burning vegetation and also burning homes. So it's a complex issue. There are multiple solutions to it. We do recommend in the Governor's Council report that more communities adopt these kinds of codes, and also recommend more technical support for communities to be able to do that through the state fire marshal's office.
You can hear the music we're getting played off. So just a couple seconds to ask about the wildfire response in the future. I mean, is the idea to eventually get to a point where we don't have to be quite as aggressive on fire suppression because of the treatment will take place over the next 20 years?
Let's hope so. The treatments should give us opportunities to corral fires to a more reasonable size and do it more safely. Firefighters out there, we're asking them to do a really, really dangerous and tall job these days when we want every fire put out so that we don't have to breathe the smoke. And it's kind of an unfair request, honestly. So by doing the work ahead of time, we can create those opportunities for a safe and effective response.
Reports are online from the Governor's Council on Wildfire Response. Chris Chambers and Representative Pam Marsh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeffrey.